Falter-Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Falter Radio, der Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Sehr herzlich willkommen, meine Damen und Herren, im Falter Radio. Die Corona-Pandemie hat zu einer dramatischen Verschlechterung der Beziehungen zwischen den beiden Supermächten USA und China geführt. Die chinesischen Drohungen gegen die Demokratiebewegung in Hongkong beunruhigen auch die Europäer. Wobei China jetzt argumentieren kann, dass sich Amerika bei den Protesten gegen Rassismus und Polizeigewalt nicht viel anders verhält. In der Weltpolitik droht ein neuer kalter Krieg. Ich diskutiere über die gefährliche internationale Entwicklung mit dem China-Korrespondenten der New York Times, Stephen Lee Myers, und dem österreichischen Asien-Experten Dietmar Schweißgut. Es ist ein Falter-Podcast in Zusammenarbeit mit dem Bruno-Kreisky-Forum in englischer Sprache, in einer Internetschaltung quer über die Kontinente. Hello, good afternoon in Seoul, South Korea, Stephen Lee Myers, hi. Very fine. And good morning in Vienna, Dietmar Schweißgut. Guten Tag, hallo. This is a Falter podcast in cooperation with the Bruno Kreisky Forum, and we are very happy to do this cooperation. It's the first project of that sort, but hopefully not the last one. And this is a transcontinental podcast. We are discussing the more and more confrontational direction in the relations between the United States and the People's Republic of China. We want to ask if there is something like a new Cold War looming in world politics and how Europe can cope with such a situation when maybe the US at one moment will ask the Europeans to take side. Maybe they are doing that already. And we want to find out what it means that the confidence in Europe in the American leadership under Donald Trump practically has disappeared. We are discussing all these topics in the days after the meeting of the People's Congress in Beijing, and the People's Congress has decided one of its main major decisions were that there should be a new security law for Hong Kong coming from Beijing, not from the Legislative Assembly in Hong Kong itself, and the Trump administration is threatening sanctions in reaction to that decision. Our panelists are Dietmar Schweißgut, who is one of the top Asia experts in Austrian diplomacy and in European diplomacy. Actually, Dietmar Schweißgut has been ambassador of the Republic of Austria in Brussels, in Tokyo, and in Beijing, if I'm correct, and if I'm not missing something. And then he was ambassador of the European Union in Tokyo and in Beijing again, I hope. I didn't forget an important assignment, did I?
No, you didn't. That's quite enough.
And Stephen Lee Myers is the Beijing bureau chief for the New York Times. Before that, he had worked as correspondent for the New York Times in Moscow, in Baghdad, and in Washington, D.C. He had published the book after his reporting from Moscow on Russian politics. The title of that book is The New Tsar, The Rise and Reign of Vladimir Putin, and he's covering now not anymore the rise of Xi Jinping, because that is over, but the reign of Xi Jinping. Stephen, nearly every day we can read your articles on China in the New York Times, but where we reach you is not in China, but in Seoul, in South Korea. So what had happened? Why can't the Beijing bureau chief of the New York Times for China not be reporting from China, actually?
Well, unfortunately, in March, the Chinese government announced that they were going to expel more than a dozen American reporters from three of the main American newspapers. the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal. And they did this in retaliation for what they said were restrictions being placed on Chinese journalists working in the United States, which the United States says they put in place because of restrictions and expulsions of American reporters. So unfortunately for those of us, and really the bulk of the American press corps, though not everyone working in Beijing, was required to leave because of this tit-for-tat cycle between the two countries. To our paper's credit,
but you still have reporters. You still have reporters in Beijing.
We have still now two reporters, and we went down from 10 on the mainland.
Dietmar Schweizgut, how often did that happen? I don't remember such a mass expulsion from China in the last years. You have been observing China much longer. Did that ever happen, such a move?
Not on such a scale, but I do remember, for instance, one case in particular of a French journalist during my second time in Beijing, whose visa was simply not extended because of her reporting on minority issues. And that was not the singular case, but on that scale Stephen just mentioned, I don't recall.
Stephen, but the way foreign journalists can report in China, did it change dramatically? I've been a correspondent in China until 3 years ago, and what did strike me was we were pretty free to move, except Tibet. We could move everywhere. Yes, we had then to cope with the local authorities, and that was often difficult, and couldn't do interviews. But we were not limited to observe. Did that change?
I think that is changing. And, you know, I've been there now 3 years. And before that, I really think that there was a period that people look back on now with some nostalgia being a period of opening. But certainly under Xi Jinping, and even in the time that I've been there, you felt a real tightening of the limits, if you will, that the authorities are willing to tolerate. I was detained 3 times by local police when I was out working on stories, and prevented from continuing that reporting. Obviously, the situation in Xinjiang, where there are mass re-education camps and prisons, the pressure from the authorities for people who try to cover that is really oppressive. And so I think for, you know, going around Beijing, generally, it may seem okay, but certainly on any sensitive subject, it's become very difficult for reporters on the ground to do their work.
Let's get into the subject of China-US relations, and let's start a bit with what's happening in the United States, these massive protests against police violence, against racism. A big movement linked to riot scenes in some spots, and President Donald Trump, who is handling that situation in a way that he fuels rather the conflict than calming, deep crisis of American society. How is that reported in China, Stephen?
You know, the important thing to understand is that in China over the last year, almost a year ago exactly, there were huge protests that erupted in Hong Kong. And those really, through the last year until the coronavirus, really dominated the coverage of China. And it led to a lot of criticism from the United States and other countries of the behavior of the Hong Kong police, the pressure from the central government, and so forth. And so when you now... And I don't think many people in the United States appreciate this, but when you see from this side, you know, similar scenes of people in the streets protesting with what they believe to be a very legitimate cause and being met with force by the police, really ugly scenes of violence for the Chinese. And the Chinese media and Chinese officials, this is a godsend because this is exactly what they say they've been facing in Hong Kong. You know, terrorists, you know, rioters in the streets causing violence. And, you know, they were offended, deeply hurt by the accusations that the police were somehow not able to respond to that, or that it was illegitimate for the police to respond. And so what everything you see in the coverage now from the Chinese side is the hypocrisy in their mind of the United States including the government calling for the use of force against protesters, calling protesters illegitimate. Of course, they ignore the underlying causes of racism, though they also are very happy to point out that, you know, the United States police have a long record of abusing their authority, especially against blacks and other minorities.
Dietmar Schweizgut, is there some sort of trying to change the argument from the Chinese side? I read an article by the boss of Global Times. It's one of the main newspapers with a nationalistic bias in China, Hu Shijin. And this guy quite often comes out also on Twitter and on other social media that are blocked in China, where he suddenly starts to present himself as a defender of human rights. And human rights were in China usually a taboo word. Is the official Chinese side just to turn the arguments around and say, okay, now we are the people who defend human rights?
Well, first of all, I would tend to agree with Stephen saying that it is really a godsend for the Chinese leadership, and sort of detracts from their own record. It gives them an opportunity also during a time when they are under attack for their handling of the virus in its early stages. So it really comes as a great time for the Chinese leadership. The interesting thing is that over the last years, I think we have seen already a willingness of China to become sort of more offensive, if you want, not just saying that this is an interference with our internal affairs. But remember, every time in the past years when the United States came up with its report on the human rights record in China, the Chinese immediately sort of retaliated by coming up with their own version of the human rights situation in the United States. What I find interesting at this time is that in one or two comments, official comments, they specifically referred to human rights violations in terms of the United States not living up to its international obligations when they refer to the convention to eliminate all forms of racial discrimination. And that I find interesting, and it's sort of a two-edged sword for the Chinese, because it could also then lead in other instances to using UN instruments like the Covenant for Civil and Political Rights, which they signed but never ratified, and say, well, these are your international obligations. So it's, you know, for the Chinese an opportunity which they exploit, but I think they're also where they cannot do it too much without really opening up the field to turning eyes back on the human rights record in China.
This is a situation that, as far as the ideological dispute is concerned, that's very similar to what we saw in the Cold War, when quite often what we could read on in the Soviet Union on the U.S., the poverty in the U.S., discrimination in the U.S. was pretty accurate. And then on the other way, the same thing, what the U.S. said about human rights in the Soviet Union was pretty accurate too. I mean, is it from the substance, is it right that Trump and the hardliners in this situation in the U.S. use the same words and a similar ideology that the Chinese use in relations to Hong Kong? How would you see that, Stephen?
Well, I think that one of the reasons they've been called out by the Chinese, and I'm not so sure that it's a very subtle response and therefore not very persuasive. But, you know, they've denounced the use of force against protesters. I mean, American officials have, the State Department, official statements. And, you know, now they're in a position where they're defending the use of force against protesters. And that exposes the hypocrisy of that point of view. Tom Cotton is somebody, the senator from Arkansas, who's been one of the more outspoken critics of China, you know, has repeatedly praised the protesters in Hong Kong for exercising their democratic rights. And yet in the New York Times even writes an op-ed saying that military should go in to crack down. And so I think that these arguments, you're right, are being sort of exposed with the contrast in China, or from the contrast to their own statements regarding Hong Kong and so forth.
The big theme of the People's Congress that has recently ended in Beijing for the international media and the international press has been this new security law that's got the green light, the go-ahead from the People's Congress, which is sort of surprising because the People's Congress in the last years, this was mostly economy. What kind of growth figures are we going to hear, and to, in which direction does the economy go? More market forces or more government control? This Hong Kong focus, was that also the focus from the Chinese side on the People's Congress? And if you look at how the Chinese side reported on that, was Hong Kong, the security law, as important as it was seen in the international media, Stephen?
Yes, in short, very much so. I mean, what I will say about the National People's Congress, it is the top legislative body for the Communist Party state, and so they are required to, you know, adopt laws and changes in the constitution. A couple of years ago, you'll remember, their main function or purpose was to endorse the removal of term limits on the presidency, which is allowed Xi Jinping, allows him now, should he choose, to continue to serve in the role that he has. This year, obviously, the main focus was on the new law, the legislative package they are putting together to impose national security laws on Hong Kong. There were others. I mean, the National People's Congress this year adopted a civil code, which was years in the making, which, you know, outlines, you know, the nation's laws on all sorts of issues like marriage and family and so forth. But I think that the since the protests last year, they were so unnerving to the central government and seen as a conspiracy to weaken the central government, that was a main focus on the security side, that they needed to authorize these laws to be put into place, because simply in Hong Kong, you know, the legislature there, which is semi-autonomous, has been unable to do so, as they were required by the basic law, which is the constitution that governs the semi-autonomous region. And so it was very much a show of force in Beijing, and I think also a reflection of their impatience, that the protest had gone on for half a year, really, until the coronavirus slowed everything down. Hong Kong was really engulfed by protest, and I think they seized the moment to, you know, try to regain control there and stamp out this protest movement.
Dietmar Schweizgut, the Chinese side is reacting rather aggressively towards the criticism coming from the U.S., also at least a little more timid from the European side in relation to Hong Kong, because they say this is an internal affair of China. Hong Kong belongs to China, but is part of the People's Republic, so get over it. This is not anymore something where Great Britain, the former colonial power, or anybody else has to interfere. We don't accept any interference. What possibilities do the Europeans or the Americans have actually to intervene, to participate in the discussion, what's happening in Hong Kong? It is part of the People's Republic of China. That's not going to change anyway.
Well, I think when it comes to Hong Kong, we have seen a development over the last years, particularly during the last 1-2 years, which clearly showed that the central government has very clearly defined limits to what they accept as political freedom in Hong Kong, and their interpretation of the two systems has shifted over time quite clearly. And I think what we are seeing here is simply one further step to undermine the autonomy of Hong Kong in terms of the rule of law, the legal system, freedom of speech, etc. So this is not something which should be that surprising, including as the timing is concerned. I mean, there was clearly the fear in Beijing that once the coronavirus situation would calm down, protests would resume. Don't forget, we have the elections to the Legislative Council coming up in September. So the big question always was, how would China ultimately deal with this situation? So the timing actually seems, from a Chinese perspective, to be quite right, you know, to have sort of a preemptive strike at the time, also when the sessions of the National People's Congress were supposed to focus much on how to overcome the crisis, how to deal with the economic situation. It deflected a bit, I think, from the fact that obviously, for reasons which are quite understandable, China is not going to reach its goal for doubling the economic output by the end of this year, etc.
But in how far is this European business or also an American business? What's happening in Hong Kong?
I think we made that quite clear, and this maybe was not reflected in all the comments, that first of all, there are about 1,600 European companies in Hong Kong. And Hong Kong, for Europeans, has always had a major interest going much beyond the size and its affiliation to China. So we clearly have, obviously, an interest from an economic point of view. The second thing is, and this came out in the statement by High Representative Borrell, when he said, well, our relations should be based on trust and respect. But what China is doing here is clearly undermining trust and its willingness to live up to its international obligations. And therefore, I think it's a further element to, if you want, inform the overall United EU policy towards China. And I think the difference with the United States and maybe with the UK position was that it was not a spectacular announcement, but it clearly showed that things will not be quite the same afterwards.
Stephen, why actually do the authorities in Hong Kong need some more instruments to control the situation? There are police arrests, there is repression going on, there is, of course, there's still press freedom, there is still an independent judiciary, there is a multi-party system, but the police seems to have all the possibilities they need. So what would be new if this law is implemented for Hong Kong?
Well, I guess I would say is that things can always get worse. And I think that one of the most chilling aspects of what they have authorized now, the National People's Congress, is the establishment of an office of the Ministry of State Security in Hong Kong. That's been a line that they haven't crossed before. And there have been reports, and some of them are quite well known, of the Chinese secret services appearing in Hong Kong and making arrests and whisking people out of Hong Kong into the mainland to charge them. The famous case of the booksellers in Hong Kong a few years ago. By moving to openly operate in Hong Kong, I think they're sending a warning to people, and it's been heard that they will be much more involved in policing there. I think there's a lot of frustration on the part of the central government that the judiciary in Hong Kong, which retains a lot of the independence that it formed going back for decades, is an obstacle, that it's an irritant in cracking down on these protests, that it gives the protesters too much leeway. The police have arrested thousands of people there, but haven't been able to bring charges against all of them because there are certain standards for bringing charges. And I think that they're looking for ways to be able to charge people under federal law there that would circumvent the local court system. And I think that's the greatest fear of people in Hong Kong. The protesters in the last few days have been focused very much on that.
The U.S. administration, the Trump administration, is threatening sanctions in case this law really starts to operate. Rather, the talk is about rather severe sanctions. Is that realistic, or is this just bluffing, Stephen? How do you see that?
You know, the fact is they can impose a number of sanctions. So we'll have to see if they're willing to go that far. But the you know, the main tool that the United States has would be to remove its recognition or its treatment, essentially, of Hong Kong under, you know, the rules of a separate from China. I mean, they treat it as a having a special trade status with the United States. And you would know better than I, but I believe the Europeans have similar arrangements with Hong Kong that are different than the mainland. But imposing those rules, which I think is really the nuclear option for the administration, would have the effect of hurting American businesses. And I think that there's going to be a strong lobby from those businesses, as there will be from European businesses, not to rock the boat so much that they lose the access to that market, because it is a hugely important one. And I really believe that in this calculus, China has factored that in and has decided that they don't care. They can look to what they call the Greater Bay Area, which is Guangzhou and Shenzhen, and they see Hong Kong really as a kind of second-tier city from their perspective. Of course, it's not. It's a global center. But from their point of view, it's an irritant. So why not have a lot of that trade, investment, the high-tech stuff, the stock markets, you know, why not have that in Shenzhen across the border, quote unquote, or you know, other parts of China? So I think they've factored in what the United States could do in retaliation and decided that it wasn't enough to stop them from doing it.
Dietmar Schweizko, do you think that basically the basic idea of Hong Kong as a place of one country and two systems, that was the formula for the Hong Kong to join the People's Republic, is that ending? And because China is not really interested anymore in such an international place, because the economic importance of Hong Kong is not as big as it used to be? Is one country, two systems ending?
Well, I think obviously it's ending, in as much as about half almost of the time which was provided for in the agreement between the UK and China, namely of keeping this system for 50 years, has already elapsed. The second thing is, as I tried to say before, this is sort of the last step we have seen in a fairly long process of eroding Hong Kong's autonomy, and therefore I think gradually we are no longer seeing one country, two systems, but maybe one country and one and a half systems. So it's clearly we are not in Hong Kong where we were 20 years ago. And I think that might continue. The as Stephen rightly said, Hong Kong probably is no longer of the same importance to China as it was. It's also, I think, a question where Xi Jinping, from his perspective, cannot be seen to be weak. And as I said before, you know, this, if another wave of protests were to come along, how to deal with that is very difficult. He might have judged that it might be easier, basically, to come up with the legislation which gives the central government a better handle to deal with protests and unrest as seen from a Beijing perspective. The second thing is that he might also see that maybe the US business lobby, and certainly also the European business lobby, might prevent sanctions from going sort of beyond a certain limit. And then they also might look a bit at the reaction they already see, you know, from statements put out by the HSBC to Nomura, saying that, well, they close down or they will reduce the operations in Hong Kong, but they will increase their operations in Shanghai, where they have a joint venture. So it might not seem to be, you know, as sort of such a gamble seen from the Beijing side.
How important has the change been in Chinese foreign policy under Xi Jinping, now also with the signals coming from the People's Congress, Dietmar Schweizko? We know earlier that there had been this formula by Deng Xiaoping, the big reformer, that China's interest is to get strong inside and just to don't make a lot of noise outside so that nobody disturbs the modernization and their economic rebound of the country. For Xi Jinping, it seems to be very important to have China as a superpower with a very assertive role in the world. How big is that change in your view?
I think it's a huge change. You know, if you look back, there never really was, for the reasons you just explained, a vision of China in the world. For Xi Jinping, this has been something which he promoted from the very beginning. Since he came to power in 2012, it soon started with the Belt and Road. But there were other areas where it became quite clear that China was going to be much more assertive in pursuing its interests, from the South China Sea to how it was talking, at least, about Hong Kong and Taiwan, which, of course, it sees as internal issues, but then also in applying pressure when it felt that countries were not living up to respecting China's core interests. And you have a long list of countries who suffered from that, you know, including European countries. So what we see is no longer only sort of the China trying to make inroads by promoting friendship and business relations and thereby also accumulating political heft and power. We see a willingness basically to apply this economic power in much rougher terms and being much more clear and outspoken. And I think the last series of comments and actions we have seen by Chinese ambassadors likened to the so-called wolf warriors are a clear demonstration that China is no longer willing basically to not assert its interests and its policies. And that is a multi-directional effort combining, I think, all instruments, including pressure, including threats, but also including, of course, incentives, which is still, I think, the main policy instrument they are relying on.
Stephen, who are wolf warriors? What's meant with this term?
So there were two movies a couple of years ago called Wolf Warrior and then its sequel, which showed a retired special services officer, you know, defending Chinese interests around the world, much like the Rambo movies of the 1980s and 90s, if you remember those. Very popular. In fact, the second one was the highest grossing film in Chinese history. And, you know, very nationalistic, very optimistic portrayals of China's power and its ability to show power around the world, taking on terrorists and bad guys and American mercenaries in the second movie. They're really quite a spectacle to watch. And I agree that there's clearly that tone has spread. And I think the tone in the movies was reflecting the official position as well.
So the diplomats are compared to these fighting.
Yeah, no, I was
movies.
Getting to that. That the tone in the official statements reflected this more aggressive, more assertive, more patriotic and nationalistic view that in the last couple of months, really since last year, you've seen diplomats who are usually quite more reserved and more diplomatic, so to speak, taking on this tone of being much more aggressive. So they've been nicknamed the Wolf Warriors, which, to be honest, I think is a little bit ironic because obviously they're still diplomats and they're still out trying to present the positive face of China, but they're doing it in a very aggressive way. And, you know, we have seen this in a number of areas with a number of countries in the South China Sea, of course, with Taiwan and Hong Kong, but also now with the U.S., given how badly relations have turned. And the one thing I would add to what Dietmar said already is that on one level, what China is trying to do is not so much challenge the U.S., but also to step into the role the U.S. has stepped back from. And so while they are being very, very aggressive, they seem to want to still defend the current world order, if you will, international law, the UN system, and so forth. So they're not defying it as much as trying to take it over and use it in a way that will benefit China and supplant the U.S. from that dominating role that they've had in these institutions. You see that with the World Health Organization, for example, right now in the involvement in the pandemic.
United States, of course, have been in the last decades the defining superpower of the international system, an imperial power. Critics would say an imperialist power. Stephen, in your view, China stepping in, applying a similar position? Is China acting as an imperial power or in some situations as an imperialist power, given the economic growth and the change of relationship of forces on the international level?
Well, I think the Chinese would argue that they're not trying to expand their reach or expand their territorial power. Some people will dispute that, especially regarding Taiwan and the South China Sea. But again, I think that what China is trying to do is take over the role that the United States once had. In other words, if they're sitting and have great influence in all of these United Nations agencies or other international agencies, then they're able to essentially dictate the terms of what is and isn't allowed or what is and isn't acceptable around the world. And for example, the pressure they put on the World Health Assembly, which just happened a few weeks ago, to not include Taiwan in that because they consider Taiwan part of China and therefore shouldn't be represented in organizations. They were successful in doing that. And the U.S. and its allies, I would say, also were really able to use these international organizations for years as sort of the liberal world order we know. And I think that China's not trying to blow that up so much as supplant the U.S. role in it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We have Dietmar, this pandemic as the big theme, not only on health questions, but even in international politics since the beginning of the year. How dramatic did the disputes about the pandemic deteriorate relations between China and the U.S. in your view? Because a pandemic, by definition, is something everybody is concerned. So logically, it would be much more logic for everybody to work together in order to fight that health problem that started in Wuhan and then this is came to Europe, came to the U.S., Latin America, and so on and so far. But the political reality is the confrontation became much more intense around the virus. How big a break is that? How big an escalation is that in your view?
Well, I think it's not only a break and an escalation in terms of bilateral relations, but if you look at the impact of this pandemic, you know, you really have to say it's the first time in post-war history that the United States has not only refused to take sort of a leading role in dealing with this crisis, but it's basically staying apart when you look at its leaving the World Health Organization. So I think it has a different aspect, which from a European point of view is maybe even more important. As Stephen was saying, China is not so much trying to create sort of a new situation. It's taking advantage of the fact that the United States is leaving the system it has created. This was a point made, by the way, in an interesting comment yesterday by a former Indian ambassador to China in the New York Times, which is why should China try to change the global system if it simply can take it over? And therefore, what we see in this confrontation, I think we see various aspects. We see a breakdown of the international system to an extent we have not seen before. And the second thing, of course, is that it is used in terms of a confrontation which really goes way beyond the pandemic, which has different aspects from clear strategic rivalry to the fact that it may be also a convenient item in the election campaign. But it is worrying, and I think when it comes to the US allies, much as we also share their concerns about the lack of transparency and what the Chinese may and what may not have hidden in the early phases of the pandemic, and much as we have pushed in WHO for an investigation to clarify this, we clearly see the more important aspect that there is a refusal to cooperate in fighting the pandemic and overcome its impact, which will be huge not only on the US, China and Europe, but on the world as such. So I think in that respect, it is a game changer, but for the completely the wrong reasons.
Strategic rivalry, this is something that the Europeans sort of not very happy with because they are not unified enough to participate in such a fight. But strategic rivalry, of course, between the US and China, despite the fact that the economic dependence, links and interdependence is still very important. Stephen, I wonder, in how far does the concept of a new Cold War between China and the US help us to understand this completely new international situation?
I think it does, to be honest. And it's obviously not an exact parallel to what happened between the United States and NATO and the Soviet Union, in the Cold War. But I think the fact that you're seeing two large powers, economic, political, and increasingly for China, also military powers, squaring off against each other and daring people to make or choose sides. And I think there is increasingly an ideological component to it from both sides, to be honest, but certainly from China's side, and no longer wanting to just be a second tier power that had to play by the rules, but to set those rules. And what you've seen, I think, with the virus, I will say honestly, I think a change in the United States point of view and the Trump administration's point of view from the beginning of the virus till now. But it definitely reflected a lot of longer term suspicions and resentments towards Chinese behavior. And if you remember back to the Obama administration, I think if I can broadly generalize their point of view, they were trying to bring China into a cooperative relationship that would avoid confrontation. In other words, that there were areas where these two countries, which obviously have differences over human rights, over Taiwan, any number of issues, but still there were a lot of ways that they could cooperate on the dealing with international security issues like North Korea and Iran, also climate change. And this administration is much less interested in that kind of international cooperation. And I think that really is what the source of the breach has been. And then with the coronavirus, I think it was just an opportunity for the administration, initially, if you remember, to praise Xi Jinping's handling of this. Donald Trump did. But then when the scale of it, of course, hit in the United States, it became more politically convenient for the administration to blame China, to raise questions about the origins, even in conspiracy theories about bioweapons and so forth. So it has very much become a political tool in our coming campaign. Until November, we're going to see more of it, I think.
In the Cold War, Europeans had to take side, more or less. I mean, you had to be on one side or on the other side. Okay, Austria was neutral, declared, and it didn't want, but was to take side. But still, Austria was, of course, part of the West politically. I mean, if Probably if the confrontation goes on, which is probably going to be the case, the Europeans will be forced even more to take sides by the Americans. But, I mean, that's already happening, and with technological questions and the way that the Americans want the Chinese company Huawei to be blocked from European markets. But what does it mean for the Europeans? If you have a situation where the Chinese say you need to take our side, the Americans say we need to take our side, and both giants don't have a leadership that looks very nice and sympathetic, does it?
Well, I think there's still a bit of muddled thinking in this issue of Europe having to choose sides in the conflict between the US and China. And I think if you do make a Cold War analogy, I think you should also say that what was always the strength of the West basically was its commitment to shared values and fighting for them in the context of an international rules-based system. And this is, I think, why the Europeans are so attached to multilateralism and why we call it effective multilateralism as opposed to the kind of selective multilateralism that the Chinese are pursuing. So starting from that perspective, you could say, of course, we have already chosen sides and we hope that the United States is still on the same side, which when you look at the means employed and the fact that the United States is walking away from parts of the multilateral system is, of course, a proposition which becomes more difficult to defend. But I think from a European point, it's very clear that we are light years away from being close to the Chinese system of autocratic governance, and we are sort of still in a military, in an effective overall alliance in the Western system. So that's the starting point. The second thing is, I think when it comes to how to deal with China, we share a lot of the analysis with the United States when it comes, for instance, to economic issues, irritants like forced technology transfer, subsidies, the way China is exploiting the WTO system, is defining itself as a developing country. So in that respect, I think we share most of the analysis. We are still in a common working group with the United States and Japan in WTO, trying to find ways to reform WTO in a way to address those deficiencies. But clearly, when it comes to bilateral relations, there are areas where we have been naive in the past. And this is why I think 2019, the European Union for the first time ever started to define China not only in terms of a partner and competitor, but also in terms of a strategic rival. And I think
in how far are the Europeans able to draw common conclusions from this analysis? Because it seems that China has many friends in Europe. There are EU countries much more aligned with China than others, and that doesn't seem, the European Union doesn't seem to have the strength really to get through a common position.
Can certainly make a strong argument on that, and solidarity basically is the basis for having a strong position. But I think one should not overplay the divisions within the European Union. Very often it is said that the eastern half of Europe is basically in China's camp. That's not quite the case. And I think if you look at what is effectively happening on the ground and you see how the European Union, by consensus, has been able to strengthen the anti-dumping and trade defense instruments in 2016-17, how we started to introduce an investment screening mechanism, which a couple of years ago would have been seen impossible. When you see the latest proposals by the Commission to strengthen state aid and competition rules to deal with China, I think we are in a gradual process of strengthening our defences while at the same time becoming much more aware that we also need a strengthened innovation and industrial policy. And that, of course, includes dealing with issues like 5G and Huawei, which I always thought from a European perspective should not only be framed in a security sort of framework, but we should also simply look at facts and be a bit like China and say, Two of the three major companies involved in providing the infrastructure of 5G are European companies, Ericsson and Nokia. Would the Chinese be in their right mind and say we would favor European companies over our own? Shouldn't we do the same thing and say, let's be clear about what we mean about reciprocity if China is not playing by the rule? But on the other hand, we still pursue this avenue in saying that if China is willing to change its attitude and agree with us on a comprehensive investment agreement, which would do away with the discrimination of European companies and would really open China's market, then of course we can have a more constructive, open relationship. But I think the word reciprocity will not disappear from our vocabulary.
Stephen, to come back to rivalry on the political level, it exists in the trade level. We discuss, we think, the dangers of a trade war, if we already are in a trade war or not. You obviously have a ideological polemic. You have a war of words. I mean, if you look a bit long term, in the next couple of years, do you think there is really a danger of armed confrontation between the US and China, an escalation going beyond political disputes, trade disputes, becoming an armed confrontation? Do you see that danger?
To be frank, I do. I think that there are so many areas of potential conflict in the Asia-Pacific that's always a possibility. And you've seen close calls between the two militaries already, and you have for a couple of years, a number of years, really. A great friend of mine who was a diplomat once told me that we spent decades avoiding war with the Soviet Union, and we know how to do that. And so I would hope that, you know, cooler heads would prevail and would avoid open conflict between two superpowers, because that would, of course, be catastrophic for both sides, I think, and for the rest of the world. But that risk exists. And I think part of the tensions and why I believe the Cold War is not an inapt analogy right now is that you feel like both sides are drawing some pretty clear red lines. And you know, that creates that tension, and the rivalry builds up and frustration builds. And, you know, I think that there's been a broad change in attitudes towards China in the United States that's bipartisan. But I also think that tensions could change in a new administration. And they could change with this administration, I think, at some other point. You know, so I would hope that, you know, the national security establishment on the United States side would seek ways to exert pressure without conflict. But you also hear these nationalistic voices coming from both sides, from both countries. And that, I think, can lead to, you know, pressure to act. If a crisis occurs, that, you know, neither side can afford to back down because of political pressures or fear of seeming weak at home. And I think that's what really creates a combustible situation.
Well, thank you very much, both of you, to Seoul and Stephen Lee Myers. Thank you. And to Dietmar Schweisgut in his Vienna home office. Thank you very much. This was an episode for Falter Radio in cooperation with the Bruno Kreisky Forum in Vienna on the danger of a looming new Cold War between the US and China, the two superpowers of the world. The Bruno Kreisky Forum does have many interesting talks and discussions, even or rather especially in Corona times, so stay tuned. And the Vienna Weekly Falter gives you insights on life in Austria, political life, social life, and of course arts and culture. You might want to consider a subscription of the Falter if you know what's going on. In Austria, you can get a subscription on the internet at the address abo.falter.at. Ursula Winterauer created our theme music. Anna Goldenberg makes sure we don't mess up too much with our audio. Goodbye, and I hope you check in for our next episode.
Sie hörten das Falterradio, den Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.